Welcome to Chapter 4. Libel is probably the most important concept we talk about in media law because it has the potential to cost media organizations the most money. Over the years, libel awards have been rising. In the last decade, the average libel judgment was over $2.6 million. That's not chump change. It can put smaller publications out of business. It can freak out larger publications. It's really a big deal now. The largest judgment to date was a 1997 award against Emmar, which is a brokerage firm, which it won against the Wall Street Journal for a publication that ended up helping to put the brokerage firm out of business. The Wall Street Journal had published a story about Emmar that had some problems in it, that basically had some information about it that turned out not to be true. However, the award against the Wall Street Journal was eventually eliminated when it was determined that Emmar had withheld information that the Wall Street Journal could have used to put a more truthful picture of the firm out. But $222.7 million makes even the Wall Street Journal wince. It's a large chunk of money, and libel continues to be a very important and very expensive proposition for many media organizations. So, a little bit of data from last decade. You don't have to know these numbers specifically, but it shows you that the trend tends to be toward additional wins for media organizations, but they still have to go to court. Going to court is an expensive process. It takes a lot of time from, you know, regular journalistic or public relations or advertising work, and you actually end up having to spend a lot of money on legal counsel. So even though the number of trials is going down and there aren't as many against newspapers, the awards are going up, but the media win rating on appeal is also going up. So it continues to be, bottom line is, it continues to be a problem, which is why libel continues to be the most important thing we talk about in common law. Okay, let's talk about some definitions. In a regular class, I would say defame me. And students would come up saying, you know, you're a slut, or you're a bad teacher, or, you know, you drink too much. All of those things would tend to injure my reputation, particularly suggesting that I'm a bad teacher, because that is casting doubt on my ability, my competence to do my job. Okay? The actual definitions tend to be impugning someone's competence or suggesting that they have a loathsome disease. So suggesting falsely that someone has herpes or syphilis is actually defamation. If it's written, it's libel. If it's spoken, it's slander. Now, however, for the purposes of this class, we're going to use libel even when we talk about broadcast defamation. So defamation is the generic term. Libel is written defamation. Slander is spoken defamation. For purposes of our class, we'll use libel for everything. Negligence. Negligence is a burden of proof that is used by private plaintiffs. I'll say it again. Negligence is a burden of proof that is used by private plaintiffs. Okay? It's not a very difficult burden to meet as burdens of proof go. It's essentially journalistic sloppiness. If I'm a reporter and I misspell someone's name in such a way to defame them, or I don't double check my facts, or I write down a wrong address or a phone number in a way that causes someone harm or damage, that's negligence. It's basically sloppiness, making mistakes that could easily be fixed. On the other hand, actual malice is a burden of proof that applies to public figures or public officials in libel suits. We're going to talk more about these as the chapter goes on. Actual malice is worse. Actual malice is actually engaging in what we call reckless disregard for the truth, which is you knew it was false and you published it anyway, or you didn't care one way or the other and you published it. Okay? So it is much harder for a plaintiff to prove actual malice than it is to prove negligence. That will become more important as we get deeper into the chapter. Strict liability is a concept that went away in libel as of 1964. 1964, I don't ask you to remember very many dates in this class. 1964 is one, though. Not only is it my birthday year, and yes, you can do the math on that, but it is also the year of New York Times versus Sullivan. Prior to 1964, the media had to prove it didn't libel someone, which is strict liability. Whenever a wrong occurs, the perpetrator is held responsible. If you've got car insurance, that has a strict liability clause in it, if you rear-end someone on the freeway, even if it's not your fault, because you perpetrated the harm, you would be accountable for it under strict liability. Now, it's no longer as important and liable as it once was, simply because New York Times versus Sullivan shifted the burden of proof, and that will become important as we get closer to that case. For right now, just recognize that strict liability says that if you perpetrated a wrong, it's your fault, even if it's not really your fault. Okay. Libel, generally speaking, is a tort action. It's civil. We don't tend to throw people in jail over libel anymore. All right, so it's no longer really a criminal action, although certainly there are certainly still laws on the books that might treat some forms of libel as criminal. Okay, we basically are talking about taking people's money. Usually we have libel in the state courts. Right, federal courts will occasionally get state cases as part of their diversity jurisdiction. So when citizens of one state sue citizens of another, like somebody in Nevada sues me in California, the federal courts may get that to apply Nevada law so that the playing field is a little more even. But generally speaking, state law is what's important here. We'll talk about that again much later on in the chapter. State actions in libel can vary. Okay? Generally speaking, they all follow the same format, thanks to the Supreme Court's 1964 case of New York Times versus Sullivan. So the libel actions are a bit more uniform. As we're going to see, the First Circuit is a slight exception. We'll talk about that a little later on in the chapter in the Noonan case. But generally speaking, libel in most of the states follows a fairly similar process, fairly similar burden of proof, set of facts, that kind of thing. And we'll talk about that standardization in just a few minutes. All right, notice that bright orange doohickey with the word test in it in the corner. That means two things. That means that the information on the slide is a legal test and that you will see it on the test. Okay? The plaintiff in a libel case has the burden of proof. I'm going to say that again. The plaintiff has the burden of proof. So if I sue the Daily Titan, the burden of proof is on me as the plaintiff. And I must prove the following elements. First of all, I've got to prove that I have been defamed. The statement has to hurt my reputation in some way. Second, I must prove that I have been identified. At least some readers, viewers, watchers, consumers need to know that it's me who's targeted in the story. Third, I must prove publication. Source, victim, one other person. Fourth, I must prove falsity. If I can't prove falsity, it knocks out one of the legs of the libel table and the libel table falls. Okay? Fifth, I need to prove fault at the appropriate level. If I am determined by the court to be a private individual, I need to prove negligence. If I'm a public figure or public official, I need to prove actual malice. We'll talk more about that. And finally, I have to prove some sort of damages that can be monetarily compensated. Lost wages, lost job, you know, doctor bills, any of that kind of stuff. The Daily Titan doesn't have to prove anything. The burden of proof is on the plaintiff. I'm going to say that again because it's an important concept. The burden of proof is on the plaintiff. Media organizations can and do raise defenses to libel cases, and we'll talk about some of those defenses a little bit later on. But the burden of proof is on the plaintiff, and the plaintiff must prove all six elements. If you want to think about libel as a table that has six legs, and the legs are defamation, identification, publication, falsity, fault, and damages, if any one of those legs breaks, in other words, if the plaintiff cannot prove any one of those legs, the table falls because it needs all six legs to stand. Okay. Let me give you an example that we'll use throughout this chapter. I call it the bad teacher example. Let's pretend, and it's not going to be any of you guys because all you guys are smart, but let's say that in a former semester, a student takes Com 407 and she doesn't do very well. She does less well than she hopes. She happens to be able, though, to work for the Daily Titan. So she writes in the Daily Titan an editorial. And the editorial says, in part, Dr. Belmas is a bad teacher because she gives men better grades than she gives women. The dean calls me into the office. The editorial is published. The dean calls me into the office. Not very happy. He says, Belmas, pack your desk. Clearly you prefer male students over female students. You give them better grades. You're out of here. So I lose my job, and I sue the Daily Titan for libel. Okay? Now we're going to talk about that particular statement a little bit more as we get deeper into the chapter. But let's work through the libel elements. First of all, I have the burden of proof because I am suing the Daily Titan for libel. I must prove that I have been defamed. Calling me a bad teacher is a really easy defamation. I must prove that I have been identified. It says my name, Dr. Belmis. There is only one Belmis, I'm pretty sure, at Cal State Fullerton. Okay, so I've been identified. I have to prove publication. Well, if it's in the Daily Titan, that's pretty easy. It's published. I also must prove falsity. So I would have to get my teaching records, all my grading records, and I would have to show them to a jury and say, here's all the men, here's all the women, and the grading is, I clearly do not give better grades to men than I do women. Actually, I don't. I've checked it a couple of times because I'm interested in that kind of thing. It's a wash. It's a horse apiece, as my father-in-law would say. Okay? But I would have that burden of proof. I would have to prove falsity. I would also have to prove fault. Now, I would argue that I'm a private person. I'm just a professor doing my job. The Daily Titan would say, well, she's a public person. First of all, she's paid with public money. And second, she teaches these really big classes and she's really well known in the comm department. It would be up to the jury to decide whether or not I'm a private person or a public person. If I'm public, the burden of proof is actual malice. I have to prove that the student either knew the information was false and published it anyway, or didn't care one way or the other. If it's only negligence, I would have to prove that the reporter was simply sloppy. It would be easier for me to win. So I'm going to argue that I'm private because I want to win, and the Daily Titan is going to argue that I'm public. It would be up to the jury to determine it. And lastly, I would have to demonstrate damages. I've lost my job, lost wages. That's pretty easy. So it's really going to turn on whether or not I'm a public person or private person, and whether or not the jury believe that the student acted with actual malice or not. How much I might, if I win at all, and how much money I might get. And we'll come back to this example throughout. Okay, let's talk about the common law. Again, I don't ask you to remember many dates in this class, but 1964 is one of them. Prior to 1964, the defendant had the burden of proof under the law of strict liability. So in other words, because the defendant had made the publication, the defendant had to prove that it had not libeled someone. And that's pretty hard to do. How do you prove a negative? Okay? In 1964, everything changed. The plaintiff, prior to 1964, only had to prove defamation, publication, and identification. Usually very easy. Those are the easy parts of the libel claim. Because usually you can prove defamation, or there's no, you know, why would you bother to sue if you haven't been defamed? Publication is easy and identification is easy, although it's not always perfect. In 1964, in New York Times versus Sullivan, everything changed. It's a major, 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 major case. The burden of proof shifts from the defendant to the plaintiff. So now the person suing the media must bear the burden of proof. The media organization doesn't have to do anything, can sit on its hands if it wants to, but it can and usually will raise defenses. Libel is also now considered to be a constitutional question, which means that the burden of the First Amendment rests on the side of the media. Okay? Sort of like the 800-pound elephant. It sits anywhere it wants to. Okay? So it's an important legal question now, and the Supreme Court has considered it to be a constitutional question. And again, media organizations don't have to do anything, but they can and do raise defenses. Who can sue? Well, if you are a living, breathing person, or you are a corporation, you may sue. Libel is considered to be a personal right, which means the right to sue for libel, generally speaking, dies with you. It's like appropriation and privacy. Now, in some states, the heirs are permitted to sue. So if my husband and I lived in somewhere in New Jersey and I had started a libel suit and then I was killed or died, my husband could bring a suit. And in many states, of course, the heirs can continue the existing suit. So in New Jersey, he could actually start the suit as well as continue the suit. And here in California, he could continue an existing suit. Group libel is a little bit tough. Okay? Generally speaking, you have to be sufficiently identified. So let me give you an example. Let's say, now I actually really like my dentist, but I'm going to pick on dentists because they have the reputation for causing pain. Okay, so let's say that I go to the dentist and I have a root canal and it's really painful, and I go home and I write on my blog, all dentists suck. My individual dentist cannot necessarily sue me for libel. Okay? Because even though I might have impugned a big group of dentists, he cannot sufficiently argue that he has been, you know, he has been sufficiently identified. Okay? Because there are, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of dentists in the state and probably many hundreds of thousands, millions more in the country. So he cannot say that he particularly has been libeled. Is there a cutoff point? Well, between 5 and 100, it's a little bit tough. It's going to be up to the jury to argue. Let me give you an example, though, from our class. Let's say that a student writes in the Daily Titan or on a blog, all Cal State Fullerton professors suck. And she happens to be in my class. Can I sue for libel? Well, all Cal State Fullerton professors, there's about, I believe it's about 2,000, maybe a little more, you know, full-time faculty members, and then you throw in all the adjuncts, that's thousands more. So probably I cannot say that I have been identified. Now, if she says all comm professors at Cal State Fullerton suck, that gets it to about 45, and another maybe 30 or 40 for adjuncts. So that gets a little closer, but still maybe not. If she says all comm law professors suck, that gets it to about 5. So that becomes a little more problematic. And if she says all female comm law professors suck, that gets it to 2, me and Professor Erickson. So we could both sue for that. So the smaller the number gets, the more likely you are to be able to be identified. And conversely, the larger the number is, the less chance of an individual being able to successfully sue because he or she has not been identified. In the bad teacher example, again, my name serves to identify me, but if the student had written all female comm law professors suck, I probably still would be sufficiently identified, as would Professor Erickson. All right. Let's talk a little bit about trade libel or veggie libel. You can actually libel an apple in 13 states. 13 states, I believe, it might be up to 15 by now, have what we call food disparagement laws. A food disparagement law essentially says that you cannot, you can be held liable for false statements that allege health risks that would cause the food product to be suffering in its sales. Okay, and the lead case in this recently is Texas Beef Group versus Winfrey, so Oprah Winfrey's case. She had a guest on her show talking about mad cow disease, and she was prompted to say, "It has just stopped me from eating another burger." Now, you advertisers know about the Oprah effect. Oprah can make or break a product pretty quickly. And as a result, a lot of beef consumers saw their sales drop. They called it the Oprah crash because a lot of people stopped eating beef. She gets sued in state court in Texas. She takes her show down to Dallas, I think it was, might have been Dallas, to defend against the trade disparagement case. But under the Texas law, she wins because she didn't say, "It has just stopped me from eating another Texas Beef Group burger," nor had she alleged that there were particular health risks about a particular food product. She said, "It has just stopped me from eating another burger." Basically, the Texas court says, well, it's not our fault that when Oprah says something, people really listen. This causes Oprah to get on the steps of the courthouse and say, "The First Amendment rocks." And of course, that bald head behind her in the picture is Dr. Phil, you know, supporting his girl. Okay.